Manafort, some of other things should really be done in a CinemaScope production, or at the least bar relief, sculpted, a symphony, or even a painted mural with that kind of figure. The best I could come up with was a narration in rhyme. I've been working on this for about 4 months, and towards the end my husband asked me, "You must feel that you know Mama Hussein pretty well by now." And I thought about it, and, "No," I said, "not really. I don't think anybody really knew Mama Hussein outside of the Bob and possibly Caduce. He's that kind of a figure. In contemporary language, he would be called a loner. He was the first to believe, you know, in the Bob. And he was a hero, he was a martyr, and he was a saint. And I was thinking about this, and I thought probably any one of us here could be a hero, because usually this happens without forethought. You're in a certain circumstance, and all of a sudden you find yourself a hero. So perhaps any one of us could be a hero. As to being a martyr, this is also possible, that anyone here could be a martyr. There are different ways to be a martyr. And if it's a sacrifice of life, you can only die once, then I really can't think of any better way to go. So far as being a saint is concerned, this is a little bit different. Not too many of us have we may have the potential to be a saint, but few of us ever do. A saint is someone who already is living in the world of God, not in the world of man. Now, remember my husband had asked this question to me. The reason I felt I didn't know Mama Hussein was that I always thought I was on the other side of the wall looking at him. And I never thought I was close. And I got to thinking, well, this is probably why the little wall in my mind's eye represented sort of a line of demarcation. Mama Hussein was in the world of God, and I was just sort of viewing him. And you never really know the saint. He was the first to believe in the Bob, but he also had another distinction. He recognized two prophets of God. This often doesn't strike home. Not only is this extraordinary, but I would say it's unique in the annals of history. It may never have happened before, and so far as we know, may never happen again, at least not for 500,000 years. This makes him, as I said, extraordinary and unique. There is not another figure like Mama Hussein throughout history in any religion. Now, what you will hear in this narration that I will be giving is based on all authorized facts as we know them. I'm not making any of it up. It's divided into three parts, this poem. The first part is called The Chief of Martyrs, and the speaker during the narration is Mullah Hussein. It's titled The Double Quest, with a subtitle of Shiraz and Tehran. Now, I'm not even going to apologize for my surgeon. Now, I've made a map here, and when the narration opens, Mohi has promised that he would sort of point out these different places. I think it will help you geographically to place the events. When the narration begins, Mullah Hussein is just coming back from an errand that he has been on for Sia's cousin. And during the time he is gone, here in Karbala, which is in Iraq, it is not in Persia, and at the time that these events take place, there was no country called Iraq. It was part of the Ottoman or the Turkish Empire. During this time, Sia's cousin, as you know, had taken over the leadership of the Sheikhs from the Sheikh Ahmad. And about this time, he was being recognized as the foremost holy man, almost in all of Islam, at least all as so far as Iraq was concerned, part of Iran, Turkey, and even Arabia. His fame had spread far and wide. But he had many enemies, particularly in Karbala. Karbala is the most holy city in Iraq, and possibly in this whole Near Eastern area. One of the imams is buried there, and has a reputation for being this very holy city. And this is where Sia's cousin was teaching and spreading the new message. Now, he had some enemies there who did not like his hearsay, or his heresy there. So they had decided to cause a little rebellion. They had were intent upon making trouble for Sia's cousin. So what they had done was to oust the official representative from the Ottoman government, and then appropriated all his money and possessions. With the idea, Arthur Luce, who was blamed on Syed Kazim and his followers, get him in trouble. However, Syed Kazim writes to the emperor, to the government in Constantinople, tells him what has occurred. So the government dispatches almost a regular little army to camp right outside the gates of Karbala. And the commander of the troops writes to the Ismaili and tells him that he would appreciate his help in quelling this uprising. Syed Kazim promises to do what he can. The commander had also written that if the uprising is not quelled, he will march in and it will not be a pretty affair. Syed Kazim tells the inhabitants of Karbala what the commander has written him, as well as enemies, but they don't believe him, or at least they ridicule what Syed Kazim says. And in fact, to prove what they think of the message and what they think of Syed Kazim, that night, it was a very foolish thing to do, they actually attacked this army that stationed outside of Karbala. As a result, the following morning, the commander with all his troops marched into Karbala. Not only they marched into Karbala, but they pillaged and they massacred 9,000 people in Karbala. They kept their word. They recognized no sanctuary, not even the imam, the shrine of the imam. In the letter, the commander had said that he would only recognize the sanctuary, the house of Syed Kazim, no one else. This is precisely what happened. They pillaged, they massacred everyone, except anyone who was in the house of Syed Kazim, as they had promised. And that day, Syed Kazim made more friends and had more disciples later on than he had ever had in his life. Certainly, this was in January of 1843, and December he died. Now, this also caused a commotion, because after this uprising and the massacre, he had by then a very great reputation, and even the shahs and the government officials in Constantinople were writing him. So when he died, this caused quite a consternation, too. Now, Mullah Hussein had been on this errand in Iran all this time. Undoubtedly, he had heard of the uprising, since it was the kind of thing that would have made headlines all over the world. So, but he was en route back to Karbala to report to Syed Kazim, so I'm not sure if he actually knew that the Syed had died at this point. So this is at the point where the narration begins. And also, Mohi, would you like to show the route that Mullah Hussein then walked to Shiraz, which is in Persia, and later when he meets the Bab, he is set on the mission to travel northward from Shiraz to Isfahan, Hashan, and Qom, and then Tehran. And this will be the route so that you can kind of keep this in your eye so you'll know more or less where the action takes place. I, Mullah Hussein of Bushri, the first to believe in him, came at last to Karbala, agitated Karbala, and asked those who remain therein, why do you tarry in Karbala? Why have you not left your homes to seek the beloved foretold by Syed Kazim? Go forth. The dawn of a new day is breaking. If he fails, what excuse will you offer the kind? Answered they with their souls uneasy, alas, our Syed is dead. Buried with him are our tattered hopes. Let us appoint thee in our stead to carry out his instructions. We cannot leave our homes, our wives, to search for the promise of God. Such a journey would disrupt our lives. We will stay here to do God's will. I, Mullah Hussein of Bushriya, quit the city of Karbala, which now had fallen still. My brother, my nephew, accompanied me past date roads to cross rivers and sands. Behind us the sea is moon-domed shrine, ahead the slopes of forest lands. We felt ourselves being drawn to Shiraz, the city of poets, the scented city. We smelled the roses at dusk, saw her gates, her white walls, the minarets moored amidst an occasional mosque. The ancient home of Persia lies near, among ruins of empires and kings, burned to the skies that cover them here, in what was once Persepolis. What do they cry from the ashes? What do the charred stones outgrow as the wind blows gently their names to Shiraz? Over the hills, through the pass, then up to the high plateau. Who remembers Parthagar? Cyrus and Darius are stoned. The rock there, Xerxes the Great. But great is the Lord of Shiraz. For him is eternity home. Outside the walls I stood, alone, haunted by the words the Seer had traced. My brother and nephew to the Masjid had gone, while back and forth I paced, begging, beseeching, and entreating God to make me a magnet, a fire, drawing me consumingly nearer to the object of my desire. The shadows not yet had grown long from the sun. The depths of my soul were aroused. I seemed to stand at the twilight of time, veiled by the mesh my thoughts had housed. Still caught in the world of duration, I saw walking from the gate a radiant youth with sad, gentle eyes. Approaching, he said, "For whom do you wait?" Perplexed, I wondered who he might be. I stared at him, but did not speak. With melodious voice he beckoned me, but I declined with tongue still weak, saying relatives were waiting inside. "Commit them to the care of God. He will surely watch over them," he replied. He turned away and I followed this mysterious and dignified guide. His garments were white as salt, his hair as black as mine. He wore the cloud green turban which signified Muhammad's line. His face held beauty, his skin glowed fair, his manner compelling and strong. All the while as we walked, his voice seemed to chant in song. If he proved to be a magician, he had already enraptured me. At last we stood before a modest home where the door was opened immediately. "Enter therein in peace, be pure." We climbed the stairs to his room, where he ordered a ewer of water be brought, scented with subtle perfume. He bade me wash from my hands and feet the stains of travel. When I desisted, he himself cleansed all taint from me. Refreshed, he now insisted I drink the tea he wished to prepare. Afterwards, I thought it best to leave and join in the evening prayer. "The hour of your return is conditioned by God. It seems his will has decreed otherwise. You need have no fear of breaking your pledge." Intense was the look in his eyes. Chastised, I knelt with him to pray, unburdening my soul. I must not fail in my search for the Lord. Aloud, I repeated those signs his return would heal. He would be young and of holy lineage, his knowledge immense and innate. He would appear in the year 1260 in Persia, the return of the final gate. "Behold, are not all these signs manifest in me?" The voice beside me in vibrant tones inquired. Stunned, I protested and denied his claim. There were many more tests yet required. Suddenly, I was filled with a fear and remorse that chilled my heart. My hands shook as I gave him questions I had prepared pertaining to the most holy book, which alluded to mysteries that only the kind could reveal. Without hesitation, he unraveled them all. Every import did he unseal. Yet, he had scarcely glanced at my treasure. "As to thy initial rejection of me," he warned, "your position would have been grievous had you not been my guest. It is not for his servants to judge God, but for God, his servants, to test." Then with incredible swiftness he wrote his commentary on the story of Joseph. So long had its secrets been hidden from eyes, so long had it whispered to ears so deaf. While he wrote, his voice played music, intonations I had never heard. In a trance, I listened to the universe sing melodies, praising God's word. At last, his pen was still. I read. His style was unique, possessing great beauty and majesty, and filled with such power that could only come from God. It was 2:11 into night, the fifth day of Jamadi Yol Aval, the year of God. The year 1260 of Muhammad's flight, prophesied even told by the stars at the time of the Lord's return, his span to herald the new age of man. All night I sat at his feet, immersed in his being, attaining true union with God. I can tell you no more of those heights of fulfillment and joy, or how odd and tender was the bond that joined me to him. Enthralled was I with the abodes of peace that I had entered secure, as he said. I longed to die that his life might increase. This night, he said, this very hour will be celebrated in days to come as the greatest of festivals, and thy praise too will be sung. O thou who art the first to believe in me, verily I say I am the Bab, the gate of God, and thou art the gate of that gate, the Bab, O Bab. See that thou tellest no one of this night. Let not thy attitude towards me betray thee, but quicken the souls of men with my light. Dawn had broken when the door closed behind me, washing the streets with its blood. The gates of God had opened wide in a rush of glory, his bright flood. The promised one had come. Arise, O people, open your hearts to his cause. His trumpet has seared the skies. Think not God will call you forever. He calls you now to paradise. Blessed nights and visitations. Many were the times he summoned me. It was written he would stand in Mecca. Soon his pilgrimage he planned by sea. But I have not to be his companion and sorrowed over this. Do not grieve, he cheered my heart. Great glory awaits thee. And now my instructions are received. Accomplished now is our covenant. Arise to defuse my cause. Alone thou must journey to the north and teach these cities one by one, Isfahan, Kashan, Qom, and Tehran. In Tehran, a secret light hidden, enter the mansion of the beloved, into the stronghold of paradise. As bidden, thou shalt find a treasure of great price. But tell no man what ye shall have found. Thou must traverse the land from end to end, with no other purpose but my cause to sound. Shower your blessings on the people, the blessings conferred by God. Speak in his name. His unfailing spirit ever will guide thee. Thy rod is the power now dwelling in thee. Your mission, which no man can offer, will be completed in its entirety. Not for one moment must thou falter and be assured of ultimate victory. He that loves you loves God. Whoever opposes you opposes God. Whoso befriends you, him will God befriend. And whoso rejects you, him will God reject. And thus it will be to the very end. His wondering teachings I took with me northward to Isfahan, where the urchins cried out as I passed, he would arise in rags, a beggar man. But the greatest divine in that city believed in the Bab and his cause. I journeyed on to Kashan, no rest for me in Kashan, north to Qom without pause, except for the sound of stirring hearts, all was quiet and calm. My own heart beat loud as I neared Tehran, the stronghold of God. There was no one to greet me, no crowd pressed forward to lead me to the mansion of the beloved. Do not ask me of Tehran and why I silent keep. Do not ask me why the nightingales and I nevermore will speak. I cannot tell you of Tehran. Its treasure I cannot disclose. Until the year 9, the secret is mine. I found the mystic rose. Now, part 2 is entitled The Black Standard, subtitled Bar Farouche. This is told by the antagonist. This one is told by one Mirza Muhammad Isaruji, which was one of the last survivors. There were 3 survivors from Tabarsi, and he is the one who is telling the story. I understand that the Farouji family is still a very well-known and respected family in Tehran. They accepted Baha'u'llah and became Baha'i. So he is telling the story in this case. Now, this takes place primarily in Bab Farouche, as you can see it here, and it begins with the march from Mashhad, which is almost in a straight line west, to Bab Farouche. I estimated this to be about 400 miles, and this is the route that they marched, the first little, you might say, the army for the Bab. Now, Mashhad is perhaps the most holy city in Persia due to the fact that another imam is buried there. And not only that, but it was stated, one of the prophets prophecies in Islam is that the Qaim himself would arrive in Meshed. So this is where also one of the Muslims constructed this little home called the Babiya, which I understand is still there and you can still see. They named this as probably the very first Baha'i center. And it was during this time that all of the Babis had thronged to the Babiya, as probably the most happy days of Mullah Hussein's life, and they were certainly the last happy days that he ever spent. But it was shortly after this in the days March towards Babul, it's now called Babul, and 100 years ago was marked for Moose. It is indeed right on the Caspian Sea. My name is Mirza Muhammad Isaruddin, the last remaining survivor of the remnant of God. I never saw the Bab, but I believed when I heard and became a servant of God. Was it my life or death I ransomed? I still bear the marks of chains in my heart from the torment of Tabarsi. The brooding makes stains in my heart that obstruct the bliss at Babylon. You think that before those memories grow dim, I can recount once more his exploits, the hero of Mazinderan. Oh, then I thought, stop just a moment. Mazinderan is not a city, it's a province. And it is, like a state. And Bar-Farouche is the, probably, I think, the largest city in the province of Mazinderan. I talked with him. Red is the color of my dreams. The massacres, the carnage, still in my head, and at night I hear my screams. You wish the drama reenacted for you? You wish to see what I have seen? The tortured bodies with the stomachs cut open, the grass indigested, still green? It was better those souls would not survive to witness Yez, Nairis, and Zanjan. How many times more must I tell it? Those events that began in Khorasan. What manner of man was Mullah Hussein? He was then not quite 35, lean and fragile to look at, but sharp with his mind and alive, keen as his sword and his bright, the sword that never left his side. For the rest, his raiment was white, save for the kind of green turban, the clothes he wore were white. I knew him as a student since boyhood, serious and quiet, of pure heart, his hand trembling when he wrote, and unskilled in the swordsman's art. Yet it would be his hand to wield a sword so sure and steady that Islam itself would yield. Both his sword and horse were given to him. His clothes were all he possessed. A striding horse with his sleeves rolled up, sword tucked in his sash, thus dressed, he marched stately at the head of his men, the black standard held high aloft, unfurled. I noticed his hands trembled less and less as our banner flew and proclaimed to the world a new day as the promise of God. Can you picture him thus, green, white, and black, dust, wind, and dirt, the colors blowing the countryside from which there was no turning back? Who were these men who followed him? 202 companions of God, untrained, seers, scholars, and students all, young and untried to the battle scene, who set out one day, in the heat of the sun, to march from the holy city Meshed, asleep in the valley of Khorasan, on the glory road across the highlands, to Bar-Farouche and Mazinderan. Awakened to fury was all of Iran, when it saw the black standard they carried, and heard their cry, Ya Sahab al-Zaman, which split their ears like a trumpet blast. Have you heard of Khorasan? An empire it was, haughty and proud in the time of the Mongol Genghis Khan, powerful and rich, at last reduced to a province by Tamerlane. And all that was left was its name and a prophecy deduced from Muhammad himself, who had warned, should your eyes behold the black standard proceeding from Khorasan, hasten ye towards them and stand guard, for they proclaim the vice-regent of God. It was an earthly emblem of an unearthly dominion, which flew until our surrender, when the plunderers of God left not one shred for the future to remember. I was one of them, I marched towards the rear, an eyewitness to all that occurred. Baccarat huddled to the west, where the flames of hate were stirred. Even now the countryside wavers. Was the mob a madman fostering treason? Were we plotting a new holy war? Some there were who listened to reason and joined us in our destiny. Some spit at us, threw stones and jeered. In ignominious Baccarat began the violence we feared. On the outskirts of that city, a savage crowd stood armed, blocking the road, hurling insults, while Mullah Hussein, unarmed, refused to draw his sword. In rage they fired, and six of our men were dead. "Not yet," said Mullah Hussein. Again their guns roared, killing a young Sikh, his favorite. "Now," cried Mullah Hussein, unsheathing his sword, singling out the one who had killed the boy. In panic, the murderer hid himself behind a roadside tree, his only ploy to make of his gun a useful shield. Right hand on the reins, his sword gripped in his left, Mullah Hussein with a single stroke, the tree, the musket, and man he cleft, all in pieces of two. One stroke only, then he turned and disappeared from sight. Just to reiterate here, he did this with his left hand. The first time he had ever held a sword or used it, he did it with his left hand, and he was right-handed. The stricken mob from Baccarat backed off without a fight. Rayal Mullah Hussein, the scholar, became a legend overnight. He had never held a sword before or scoped a young girl's hair. His only friends had been his books. Even laughter in him was rare. From that moment when his sword turned red, his hands were steady, assured. From that moment when his sword knew blood, his sword and hand as one endured. His very name evoked such fear that it caused an army to flee. The power of God transformed him, and never the same would he be. The poets began to sound his praise, while the Grand Vizier Taki Khan, in his madness in the palace at Tehran, swore an oath on the Holy Quran to crush the bones of the new believers and turn our glory to dust. His thighs were loose to strangle our faith, but the air was charged with our cry of Ya Saheb al-Zaman, O Lord of the Age, thou hast come. Like bells we rang, and we told the death of the Shah. A muted prayer was a song we sang. Meanwhile, in Baccarat, evening came, and with the evening suspicions, Mullah Hussein had made peace with the city, demanding none of the usual conditions. We quartered at the caravanserai and asked for water and bread, but they would not sell or give us food. So we took our food with God instead, to call the faithful to prayer. A hungry youth responded gladly and climbed the roof, chanting, God is great. A bullet struck. We watched him sadly, wilt in a heap, the prayer unfinished. Twice more two youths climbed the roof to utter the call in futile attempts. There were no faithful in Baccarat. The proof was three dead bodies testifying. Once more we gathered our swords and our steeds to attack the twilight forces and avenge their cowardly deeds. Defeated, they begged us for peace, and once more we gave them our trust. Now there lived the Sayyid al-Ulama in a mansion long since turned to dust, whose hate and fury drove him to pray for the death of Mullah Hussein. His sickened soul began to plot the crimes that at length diseased his brain. This is the man who, we are told, later on all these events had transpired, who contracted a fever that evidently was so intense that no matter how many robes or how much he, many things he wore, blankets, all to keep warm, he could never keep warm. He was always, always cold. And eventually this beautiful home of his crumbled into dust, and the people in Baccarat got into the habit of throwing garbage and refuse on it. And then saying, may your house suffer the same fate as the Sayyid al-Ulama. Anyway, this is one of the arch enemies here. His partner in this treachery was Abu Kholi Khan, the province chief. Together they planned to dispose of us. twice more they were to cause us grief, while offering their hands in peace. The townspeople wrote a petition, to which Mullah Hussein agreed, that we would leave on the morrow with safe escorts guaranteed. The Ulama had hired the assassin Khosrow, a notorious bandit and rebel, that one, whose band was to lead us to ambush, and he paid for a job well done. That dawn, we rode out of Barkharush, mounted with Khosrow and his 100 men. Our own companions counted 200. I rode in the rear. His path led through the thickened forest, and he bragged about his adventures. Mullah Hussein advised him well. It is best ye do not evil in this matter. If he persists, it will return to you. There was silence. Then, I am Khosrow, a man of scruples. You must learn to have confidence. It is true they sought to bribe me, but I said, thank you, I'm for hire to murder the sons of Islam? Why, they are more faithful than you. I will conspire to take the lives of those who prefer to sacrifice three boys, then leave unfinished the call to prayer. He laughed, and our hopes diminished. His eyes and teeth shone white when he laughed among the darkened trees. Suddenly Khosrow gave a shout. He had no more time for pleasantries. It was a signal to attack. The battle was short and resplendent. The fiends were all put to flight, save one, Khosrow's attendant, who, while the fighting raged, was summoned to prepare the water pipe. So certain was Khosrow's victory. While waiting to smoke, his vanity ripe, he demanded Mullah Hussein's horse and sword. Mullah Hussein in prayer had bent, and no reply did he make. Unknown to Khosrow, the battle was spent, and now a companion, a gentleman poet, came forth to ask permission to light his bowl. Kneeling, he thrust his hand into Khosrow's robe. With all his might, he plunged the knife, Khosrow's knife, deep into his side. Elegance had claimed his life. By his own blade, Khosrow died. Just to explain this a little bit further, evidently when they had marched through the forest, they didn't have to take the forest. Khosrow deliberately chose the path through the forest, hoping that this would be a perfect place for ambush. He evidently rode side by side with Mullah Hussein, and so when he gave the signal for attack, he and Mullah Hussein did not fight. Evidently, Khosrow had no intentions of drawing his sword against Mullah Hussein, whose exploits he had already heard about. So evidently, they retired a short distance from the actual battle, which was raging a little ways off. And Mullah Hussein had knelt down to pray, while Khosrow, to show his arrogance and what he thought of the whole battle, decided to smoke and had his attendant light it for him. But in the meantime, the battle must have been less than a half an hour. One of the bobbies, this gentleman poet, comes and asks permission to light Khosrow's pipe. I don't know why he let him, but he did. And he takes the knife and then just plunges it into Khosrow. The Sa'id al-Ulama had bribed him with money and a curious pact. I myself accept all guilt for your murderous act. Be not afraid to slay them all. On you there will be no blame. On the day of judgment, it is I who will answer to God in your name. The attendant was sent back to Barkharush to relate all that had occurred. The news inflamed the populace and new attacks were stirred. Meanwhile, the Sa'id al-Ulama had written a lengthy note to our new young king, Nasir Din Shah. Kill the Babis, in venom he wrote, who have raised the standard of revolt. Even now they sit in a holy shrine, which they have turned into an arsenal. Such is the desecration of these swine who plot to attack thee in Tehran. They have proclaimed a new holy state. I fear for thee, for all of Iran. Many villagers have joined their cause. You must send an army to wipe them out. Great is the power that is Nasir Din Shah. It was October 12, 1848, that began the siege of the shrine of the Sheikh Tarasi. Our fate to May 10, 1849, was sealed in victory, straight with pain, but counted the glories of Mullah Hussein. the last part is called a siege, subtitled The Fort of the Shrine of the Sheikh Kabar Siege. And this was told by the antagonist, who is the prince, Mehdi Kole Mirza, who is actually a brother of the late Muhammad Shah, who had just died while these events were transpiring. And most of this now will occur, I don't know if you can see it in red, the shrine of the Sheikh Kabar Siege is about 14 miles southeast of Barfarouche, so on Thursday it is kind of a swampy grassland, and it is surrounded by mountains and hills. And this is where all of this action will take place. And this is told by the way, as I said, by the commander of the royalist forces, so you will get his version of what is transpiring. I may have to interrupt him from time to time to tell you what actually took place. Recalling the entire unpleasant episode can do nothing but turn up the rocks and mold that lie buried beneath the stones of Kabar Siege, the swampland, the hills, and the bodies cold, the rusted cannonballs, the iron casings we unleashed on them at the body fort. I remember the siege and surrender well. We discussed it often at court. Tell me, is it true the faith of the Bab has grown, that there is now a leader even greater than he? Strange that in retrospect so little was known that we thought we killed their faith when we killed them all at Kabar Siege. The men who fought with me, my friends, all are gone. I have never known if I retired in honor or disgrace. There is no way of knowing what is right or wrong. For religion, I have always had this taste. I did not hate the bodies. I considered them traitors to the Muslim state. As such, they had to be subdued. Despite what Abbas Kole Khan may have told you, it was he who wanted the glory, and so started the feud that led to so much confusion in the field. But it was I, Mehdi Kole Mirza, a prince, who routed the Babis and scourged their fort. As for Kole Khan, who has seen him since? You ask me now of Moab of Singh. I always saw him from a distance. He seemed a giant of a man for these parts. Actually, Moab of Singh was very small. The treacherous, cruel, and cunning stance with his sword gave rise to that expression was not his, the sword of Gideon. His disciples, as such, were always quoting scripture to explain themselves. However, religious matters have never concerned me much. I first heard of Baba Hussein from Abbas Kole Khan, the same who had contrived with Khosrow to put an end to the Babi ban. Abbas Kole Khan was as much a peasant as that scoundrel outlaw, may his fate be the same as the Sayyid al-Ulama. At any rate, he sent me that awesome trophy, the musket Mullah Hussein had cut in two with one gruesome stroke, man as well as tree. My orders were to crush him and the Babi fort. You shall be convinced that the part I played absolved me of any guilt. Rather did it prove the tremendous patience I displayed. But first I must straighten out the facts. The Babi said they were 313 men, and quoted from a prophecy again. They numbered closer to 3,010, mathematical living, if you believe their lies. According to my account, in that unholy shrine, 1,500 Babis perished there, while only 500 men were killed of mine. From what I have been able to gather, those figures are probably reversed. There could never have been that many people in the shrine to begin with, and they started out with 313, and they ended up with, I think, 201. But during this time, many people came. Many men had come on and off to the fort to fight with them. So it is possible that during this 11-month siege, that they lasted 11 months, it is possible that 500 Babis were there. I don't know if all of them were killed. Well, eventually, of course, almost all of them were killed. So it's more likely that at least 1,500 of the royalist forces were killed, and probably closer to 500 or so of Babis were killed. Let me describe the fort shrine to you. The building stood in a grassy place, encircled by a thickened hedge and tall. Beyond was a moat, 10 feet deep. No trace remains of either one, they tell me now. Behind the heads, they built a wall of stone, 10 meters high, which surrounded all, on top of which they placed their armaments. Gone is the wall, crumpled by our artillery. 1,000 bodies once stood guard up there. Inside, they dug wells and underground tunnels, storehouses for food and ammunition spare, with all which they stole from us on their forays. The shrine itself was rather small, no more than 50 by 25 feet, consisting of two rooms only, each wall with faded plaster from the summer heat. Yet fresh each day where they emerged for battle, shouting in unison, Ya Sahadu Saman, they behaved and sounded much like cattle. In the meantime, the ulama burned with wrath and demanded an immediate assault. The strange circumstances which then occurred was really nobody's fault. An army of 12,000 men set out to lay siege to that motley host. Their first night out, a torrential rain caught them, and their way was lost. Their guns ruined completely by mud. The second night, a snowstorm raged, the worst ever seen in Mazandaran. Being superstitious, the entire army dispersed. On the third night, what was left of it, the bodies attacked, and the stragglers retreated, leaving 400 of their dead behind. The bodies claimed their forces were depleted by not even one. No one believed them. It was then I was appointed lieutenant of the king in charge of all operations. Hopes ran high for the success my military background would bring. It was near Christmas, your year, 1848, when I led my first advance to Boska, a small village near their fort. During the wait, I sent a message to Mullah Hussein as a joke, to please enlighten me as to his intentions. With great seriousness, he made reply, and amused me much with his scholarly mention. 3 days later, we prepared the attack, with 3 regiments each of cavalry and infantry poised on hilltops. They did not choose to meet us there. In a misplaced show of bravery, they attacked me at Vodka instead. The one called Caduce was wounded that day, while Mullah Hussein stole my favorite sword. From that moment on, I swore he'd pay. To explain this, you can't quite get it in this, but this is really quite a strategy that the bodies used. They were down below in this grassy place, while up on top of these 3 regiments, mind you, 3 of cavalry and infantry, both, were all in proper position, according to the rule book, on top of the height. Now, they were all there, ready to go, ready to do battle the following morning. They assumed the Bobbies would follow the book and also do battle with them the following morning. And in true Persian manner, the commander, for some reason or other, they never fought at the head of their men, much less even accompanied them. So that the prince was not even with his men. He was back in his village. He had taken his apartments and was retiring for the night. So the Bobbies, what they do, they come out of their fort around the flank, and of course the army sees them and starts firing at them, but do no damage. They have no leader, really. So the Bobbies completely bypass them. They don't do battle with them at all in the morning. They come out at night. Completely bypass the army, go to the village of Vodka, and whatever men have been stationed there, they are put to the sword. They go to the apartments of the prince, this Prince Kuli that we had mentioned, and in the meantime, he realizes something is wrong. So, in his nightshirt, no shoes, barefoot, he jumped out of the window, and in the snow, he wanders dazedly around the countryside all that night. A farmer finds him finally in the morning and feeds him, gives him clothes, and his farmer, in fact, even offers to round up his army, saying that you can still fight today, I'll round up the army for you. But the prince has evidently had enough. He declines, and he takes off and runs away to another village inside. In the meantime, his poor army, having no leader, during what has happened at Vodka, but their leader is gone, they disperse. They wander rather aimlessly about, not knowing whether to go home or to stay, and eventually they all leave, and Mazandaran, by this one act of cowardice on the prince's part, almost all of the people in this province decide to leave. And there are very few people left around Kabarsi at this point, many villagers. Did I tell you the story of a traitor, Riza Khan, who marched with me to Vodka? And oh, said he, no one will be more courageous than I, a fool, vainglorious, a highborn braggart. Just see how many bodies I will kill for you. At the first shot, he deserted to the enemy's side, where he knelt and kissed the foot of Caduce. You'd think he was some idiot's bride. On him, too, I swore revenge. He would stand at the gatehouse and taunt us, calling, who is man enough to join me? There is not one of you can daunt us. Join me in the company of the saints of God. I hated him and waited for the day of surrender when I ordered his body hacked to pieces. What advantage, then, did his manhood render? By February, we had massed again our forces. Four regiments and cavalry camped on the heights overlooking the meadow of the fort. Kublai Khan had combined his troops, though by rights the command was still mine. Then, without warning, he began to prepare for his siege of Tabarsi. He threw together seven flimsy barricades. He would not need my help, he informed me. But I sent him reinforcements without delay. Behind his seven barricades, his army and he hid themselves and there planned to stay until the body surrendered. Malhar Singh, one cold winter's day, stood alone in the snow outside the fort. Around his shoulders a white shroud, hunched over his sword to lean. He called out in a voice impassioned and loud, O people, why do you act so cruelly towards us? At least give us passage that we may leave this land. My men grew softened, so orders were given to shout and fire their guns in order to drown him out. Again Mullah Hussein raised his hand and leaned on his sword, his voice now trembling. Is there anyone who will help me? Three times he pleaded this cry to the silent regiment, which openly wept. So moved were the men, I thought betimes they would surely desert and pay allegiance to him. But Kublai Khan's barricades fell, all seven, one memorable night, all praise to the intrepid Mullah Hussein. Where was Kublai Khan all at this time? Why, up in a tree, as usual. Where always he hid. Although he deserves some credit for what he did. From his vantage point, the Babi leader he spied, mounted on his horse, the only one left uneaten. Dressed in white, the green turban perched in its pride on his head. Suddenly his horse stumbled, entangled in some rope. Mullah Hussein stands bright, the full moon pointing at him. Kublai Khan takes careful aim and fires. What a prize he has won this night. Later he claimed he did not even know who it was he had killed. Many were killed in the moonshine while carrying his body back to the fort. I heard they buried him deep in the shrine. That makes it double holy. The pilgrims will have to circumambulate twice to do them justice both. Thus ended the life of Mullah Hussein. He paid the greatest price. Honest Kublai Khan fared little better. His army was routed to utter defeat. A Babi betrayer had written him a letter to ask why he did not complete the battle he had begun. He informed him of their leader's death, how the besieged were reduced to starvation, some subsisting on water alone, while for others, their only ration was leather, grass, and powdered bones. In fact, so great was their culinary need, they were forced to dig up and eat Mullah Hussein's famous feed. 100 men, the betrayer added, could easily capture the fort. So my colleague made one last attempt at a blaze of glory that was all too short. Two regiments of infantry and cavalry again enclosed the fort and began their attack, artillery and cannon booming all at once. As to what happened, we all know for a fact the great Aga Kublai Khan and his fearsome array were put to flight by 18 men. The ensuing panic was an awesome display. 18 bodies galloped into their midst and enshrined forever their king. With courage heavy, a frightened Kublai Khan fell off his horse and in his shame left one sore boot in his stirrup dangling as he ran for advice to me at last. Great harm had been done. The world laughed at us. From the Shah came a stern command, blast the bodies or forfeit your life. Immediately I asked for proper reinforcements to end the fanatical strife. Cannon, bombshells, and flame projectiles began their merciless ravages. Inside the garrison, Caduce and his men fought like emaciated savages. Those fools would raise up a cry of joy whenever one of their number was slain. He watched their clothes rot away from their skin, steeped in mud, the cold, and the rain. And still they withstood and held fast. Their fortifications were battered. They were surrounded by death and smoke. By now, nothing else mattered but to crush them, to kill or maim. Their outer wall was a smoldering ruin. They yelled, Ya Sahab al-Zaman, just the same. Once I ordered a ceasefire, and those who attempted to flee were shot when they were caught. For four more months, that ravished band endured my furious, fiery onslaught. By now, there was little left of their defenses. Those bodies simply were not human. On the last day, I sent an emissary with a plan that attested to my acumen. I requested to negotiate with Caduce and swore on the Quran I would do no harm. He came with 202 of his men who still remained. I evinced great charm and prepared a table of delectable food, which they refused to eat. It was this influence from these dirty beasts that finally broke my trust. I had been ready to show them benevolence, but decided to avenge my wrongs instead. We plundered and then demolished their fort and cut to pieces any who attempted escape. Considering their condition, they were a hardy sort. Three wealthy ones asked to be ransomed. To my knowledge, they were the only ones we let go. As for the remaining few, excepting Caduce, we laid them down in a ragged row and split open their bellies, one by one. The date was May 9th, 1849. My intent was to silence history when I silenced the bodies at the Sheikh's shrine. What manner of man was Mullah Hussein? He was 36 when he died. The chief of martyrs, Baha'u'llah, named him. Name him saint or hero, his tears are dried, as dried his blood in the meadow grass. None of these things had he meant to be. His hand was bound to book and pen. No military soldier, he. Yet his hand held the sword of Gideon. In his heart, he held God's truth. O Persia, gather your young and show them your sharp-edged tooth. Two prophets of God you devoured, whose apostles rained blood for your sake. Grow glory from the blood of the martyrs. The harvest is yours to take. Reap pride from the acts of Mullah Hussein. Be assured of your destiny. What will you tell your children? O Persia, what will your story be? Lean and frail form was he, but keen as his sword in his bright, the sword that never left his side. For the rest, his raiment was white, save for the kind green turban, the clothes he wore were white. He appeared and he cast a shadow, shaped like the crown of might. The chief of martyrs, Mullah Hussein, the first to believe in him, was slain.